Welcome to Political Rewind. It's a Monday afternoon, and, you know, we're back to having so much to talk about. I can't believe it. I thought after the 6th District race, Jim Galloway, things would slow down. No chance. So I'm very glad you are here to help us unwind everything.
I'm a constitutional lawyer of some note, so my presence is greatly desired here
Jim
today.
Jim Galloway, chief political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read his column on Thursdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the paper, and of course he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. Theron Johnson, we're glad to have you back. You're on the road so much since you started your new company called again?
Paramount Consulting Group,
a bipartisan political consulting group. We'll see if that works. It's a bold experiment.
Absolutely. I had dinner last night with 6 Republicans, and so I'm doing pretty well.
All right, who paid?
I paid.
Oh, well, see, already, you know, you're
word
letting
is going to get around fast.
And, of course, Theron's been very active in Democratic politics. He ran the campaign of Barack Obama in 2012 down here in the Southeast. A close ally of Mayor Kasim Reed's, and so we're always glad when Theron's not on the road on a Monday, and we're awfully glad that Brian Robinson, who is a Republican strategist and the former communications director for Governor Nathan Deal, good to have you back in the studio, Brian.
We're making Mondays great again.
And on the telephone, I'm sorry, not on the telephone, in the NPR studios in Washington, I'm delighted that we're going to greet Alex Altman. He wrote the cover story for Time magazine that talks about the Trump Hotel and all of the potential conflicts of interest that it raises. Alex, thank you so much for joining us. You really dug deep on that and gave us a lot to talk about.
Glad to be here. Thank you guys for having me.
Let me start real quickly with a couple of breaking stories. The Supreme Court had 3 announcements this morning, one of which was an actual decision handed down. The other two were announcements of cases they're going to take up. Jim Galloway, you think the most important one today was, in fact, the decision. They ruled in favor of a Missouri church which had applied for federal funds to resurface their playground.
I believe it was state funds to resurface.
Okay, state funds.
Fine. And the state constitution of Missouri says no money shall ever, and that word is ever, be handed over to a religious organization. No state taxpayer money shall ever be had. And Roberts led the decision on that.
7-2.
7-2 said it was active discrimination. Of religious discrimination, and that could redefine the relationship between state, local, and federal governments and religious institutions. If you take that issue and you apply it to, say, religious education.
Yeah, the ruling, which Chief Justice Roberts wrote, says that it was odious to our Constitution to exclude the church from the grant program, even though the consequences are only a few scraped knees. You're going to do this surface, this recycled rubber tire surface. So that's an important decision. But they also agreed to take up the case that everybody has heard about by now, because it became ubiquitous back when we were talking about religious freedoms and how they rub up against things like gay marriage and that sort of thing. The Denver baker who refused to bake a cake for a gay couple went to court when he had been told he could not refuse to bake that cake. And that's gone all the way up. And the court in the fall will hear the case as to whether businesses have the right, on the basis of sexual orientation and other factors, refuse service. So that's another big one.
That's going to probably come down this time next year.
And finally, the court has agreed to take up the Trump travel ban. Really, the case will be the extent.
It's not a ban. It is a suspension.
Well, I can only take the president at his tweeter words. But in any case, they will determine the extent to which the president has the power, the executive has the power to implement immigration policy, or the extent to which he needs to turn to Congress to implement things like what the president has tried to do, the 6 countries that he wants to stop immigration from currently. But the court did something very important. This was an unsigned statement from the court in which they said this ban cannot exclude people who have ties to this country that are meaningful. Students who are coming in to study, people who have families, that they cannot be excluded. You probably, if you heard the NPR news report just a minute ago, heard there are batteries of attorneys already spreading out to airports around the country to make sure that that ICE does not overstep its bounds on this. And the court also said that the Trump administration said this was temporary. They wanted 90 days to put tougher immigration and refugee laws into effect, and they take the administration at its word that they should be able to do that. So three really interesting rulings from the court. Anybody want to weigh in real quickly before we move on?
This is, I'm glad to see that the court has backed up this executive order. It is well within the bounds of the powers of the presidency, and I really felt like some of these lower court decisions were almost a bit too celebratory in their, sort of giving the pushback on President Trump. So I think this has provided a little more balance. And two, what concerns me about the ruling is that bona fide connection. Well, what the heck is that? I mean, this is a lawyer's paradise. It is exactly the sort of gray area that's going to have to be go to court over and over and over again. Let's say, yeah, it's fine. You got 90 days. Let's see what you come up with, and then we'll go from there. But this is, they're going to be able to find a connection to, it's like to a person or organization. You're always going to be able to find something. And this country has the right to determine who and from where we accept All right. immigrants.
Brian Robinson clearly is going to be at the airport here in Atlanta fighting
I think
any
with
of the
cattle prod. The thing to note is that that Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch actually they just wanted the ban implemented in full force.
Yeah.
So you kind of know where this is headed.
Yeah.
But I will tell you what. One thing that I really want to know whether the Supreme Court is going to take up the matter of Trump's tweets on this topic.
Yeah, that's exactly
campaign rhetoric.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, one other quick thing, and we're going to talk about health care later on, but another breaking news story. The Senate... Senate Republicans who have been working on the health care bill have released a few changes just in the last hour. So we don't have full details on it, but we do know the most significant change is that the legislation now includes a penalty for people who allow their health coverage to lapse for at least 63 days. Theron, that's put in there by the Senate because there's concern that with a mandate taken out, people no longer are mandated to buy health care. That 63 days is supposed to keep people from just applying for insurance once they're sick. Now, we'll see how well that carries in the Senate right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you just look at where the bill is right now, I think you have at least five Republican senators who are on the record saying no to this bill, and I think you have maybe two to three who are basically saying they're undecided.
Right.
I think the bottom line is that this was just really rolled out just incorrectly. I mean, when you have the leader of the Republican Party, Mitch McConnell, kind of going back and forth with the leader of the Democratic Senate, Chuck Schumer, and really just kind of giving off this where he's hiding in it. We don't want to reveal it into the American people until it's dropped. And so I like to say that this is really dead on arrival because, I mean, they definitely don't have the votes right now in the Senate to get this
All
passed.
Right, we're going to talk about that a little later in the show, but let's turn to Alex Altman. Alex, thank you for being patient as we went through those few news headlines.
Sure thing.
We were struck, producer Lisa Clark was struck, and I was too, by your cover story on the conflicts of interest that are posed primarily by the new Trump International Hotel in Washington, but as you point out in the article, certainly the potential conflicts for the president and his businesses are not limited to that venue. But if you would, let me give you the chance to sort of tell us in the broadest way what you found as you looked into the Trump International Hotel.
Well, I think the first thing is the context. Of all the ways that President Trump has shattered custom in Washington, this is one of the most pronounced. We have never had a president, at least not in modern times, take office with a real estate empire that stretches around the globe, including outposts and geopolitical hotspots that range from India to Turkey to the Philippines. We've had plenty of rich presidents, but Trump's predecessors have often gone to great lengths to assure the public that they haven't mixed the presidency and the office of the people with their own personal profit. What they've often done is divested business assets. They've placed them into blind trusts administered by an independent third party. And what Trump has done, in contrast, is to step away from the operations of his businesses, but not relinquish ownership. Now, his lawyers say that that's enough in the eyes of the law, and you know it's worth pointing out that I think that there's a good chance that they're right. But in the eyes of ethics watchdogs and some good government groups, lots of folks on the left, it doesn't do enough to mitigate the appearance of conflicts of interest, and the hotel is the epicenter of this kind of unusual new situation.
You point out that according to the president's own financial disclosure statement in 2016, he owns a virtually 77% share in the limited liability company that controls the hotel. And you tell us, of course, that since the president took office, he handed responsibility off to his son, Donald. And then you go on to say the potential conflicts of interest are dizzying. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, just to note with the ownership share, we've since the article was published, according to Trump's financial disclosure, that he made about $20 million, or the property has raked in about $20 million through this spring. So clearly, you know, he's making money off of this. The fact is, Trump International Hotel in Washington has become, as we put it, a town square of sorts under the president's administration. It's just a couple blocks from the White House. You can, I think, see it from the White House lawn. And as a result, it's become kind of a magnet for all the types of people who want to curry favor with the Trump administration, whether it's lobbyists or foreign diplomats, Republican operatives, and, you know, even governments who want to stage events there.
Let me ask you to jump in here. And this is Jim Galloway here. We have had Roosevelt's. We've had Kennedy's. The Rockefellers have gotten pretty close. I mean, is the difference here that all those men were and they were men, were sitting on top of stashes of cash that had already been made, and that Trump is still in the process of becoming the billionaire that he claims to be?
I think that that's a large part of it. I mean, piece of it is the way that he's handled his business and sort of the unwillingness to fully disentangle himself. You know, as I've said, the lawyers say that it's enough simply to wall himself off from the operations of the business. But, you know, he is still the person who's pulling in profits. And as we see this week, I mean, the president is going to be headlining or hosting a fundraiser for his 2020 reelection campaign at Trump International Hotel, just a couple blocks from the White House. You know, that's sort of a strange convergence of his roles as businessman, as president, and as candidate.
Yeah,
the Trump Hotel is in the old postal building.
Post office building,
and it's been many things through the years. When I was coming through as a high schooler, we went there, and it was shops and restaurants, and the federal government owns it. So isn't it true that Trump making money at the old post office is making money for taxpayers because he's paying rent to the federal government?
Yeah, but Alex, you in your article have another take on what Brian just referred to, and that's whether the president can, in fact, be both landlord and tenant of this building.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Brian, I think you're right in the sense that GSA was very eager to proceed with this redevelopment project. I mean, the old post office, which is an absolutely beautiful building, has struggled a bit in recent years, and in fact has almost closed down several times during the previous century. And the Trump organization has done a very, very nice renovation. I mean, it's an opulent building. There's no question about that. But I think that, you know, there are other questions about the propriety of the commander-in-chief, who has the power to hire and fire the head of the administrative agency that controls the old post office, acting in a sense as both landlord and tenant of the building. And in fact, the lease that the Trump organization signed appears to explicitly forbid exactly that. And the GSA has sort of done some interesting somersaults to allow the president to continue to the president's company, his real estate empire, to continue to oversee the hotel while he is in office.
Theron, Democrats on the Hill have been calling for oversight committees to look into this arrangement to no avail. And while Alex really gets into great detail on this, he really the big story, as he know, as he said in the article, is this the kind of conflict that casts doubt on the credibility of the president as he makes decisions? For instance, Alex points out in his article, Theron, that the Saudi Arabian government has spent something like $250,000 or more on the hotel since he came into office.
Well, first of all, Alex, thank you so much for writing this piece, and don't let my good friend Brian get you off message by bringing in the GSA and the federal building. You know, I have said since Donald Trump was elected that he was a walking conflict of interest. And all this does is proves that notion, because at a time where we want this president to try to pass a health care bill to make sure that these 20s, I think I heard Secretary Price on CNN this weekend saying that there's roughly 27 million people out here in the country right now that does not have access to health care. But instead, he is that hotel. And Bill, you teased me earlier about Republicans, but it is the place where if you want to go meet a person in the Trump cabinet, if you want to go see someone in the Trump administration, or if you want to see someone who's going to meet with the White House, they're all staying at this hotel. I mean, it's like the Republican hangout spot right now. But this president should say, you know what, I'm going to totally recuse myself from all operations. I'm not going to run this hotel. I'm going to make sure that the American people can trust that I'm focused on doing the job that they elected me to do, and that is to become president. But the other thing that I think is just really discouraging about all this is that you're right. I mean, the ethics departments are investigating him. We haven't had anything yet. So I just really want to hear more outcry from Democrats to really encourage them to look deeper and deeper into these conflicts that the president obviously has right now.
Yeah, let me tell you, I would love for a Democrat to spend a lot of time talking about ethics and Russia, which have one thing in common: Americans don't care. And two, it don't impact Americans' quality of life or their incomes. And that was one of the major problems that we've seen with the Democratic strategy in these House special elections. They're talking about Trump, and it's just a completely negative attack on Trump. They're not talking about health care. They're not talking about infrastructure. And, you know, Trump, to his credit, is talking about those things.
Let me, Jim, real quick, and then I want to get Alex back.
Okay.
In.
Well, no. I'm trying to draw Alex in as well here. Alex, we've got you've talked about the hotel, but we do have two lawsuits that exist right now focused on the emoluments clause. One is by Crew, and the other is by scores of Democrats, congressional Democrats. Have you taken a? I mean, what are the prospects there? I mean, is this just this?
All right. Let me ask you to do something even more immediate, and then turn to Jim's question if I can, Alex.
Sure.
You know, emoluments clause has suddenly become a word that people have tried to understand and to pronounce. So tell our listeners, just to be on solid ground here, what is the Emoluments Clause?
So the Emoluments Clause is a pretty obscure provision in the Constitution that tries to prevent it, you know, dates back hundreds of years, and it's never really been tested in the courts, but it essentially tries to bar transactions between foreign governments and U.S. government officials in an attempt to avoid them taking money that could affect the actions that they take in office.
Okay. And now to pick up on what Jim said, yes, there have been suits contending that he is in violation of the Emoluments Clause because of the governments that are doing business at the hotel. But you also point out in your article that the way the Trump, I don't know if I say the Trump family or the Trump White House in this case, has responded is to say that any money that the hotel makes off of foreign governments, like the Saudis coming in and booking rooms and the other governments you mentioned in your article, they will turn around and donate back to the federal government, right?
That's correct. So Len, let me just sort of take those in turn. What we've seen is diplomats representing a number of nations. You mentioned the Saudi lobbying, but also the embassies of countries like Bahrain and Kuwait. And we've seen a U.S.-Turkish trade coalition designed to promote ties between the two countries through a major conference there, oftentimes switching the venue since the president took office. So the question is, can any of these lawsuits essentially prove that the president has violated the Constitution by owning a hotel that takes in money for doing this? And the answer is quite possibly no. There's a question of whether or not groups like CRU, which is a left-leaning good government group, whether the attorneys general in places like Maryland and the District of Columbia, whether or not there's a wine bar up 14th Street, you know, a couple miles from the White House that's sued as well, claiming that you know, the president's ownership stake in the hotel affects their own business prospects. Now, none of these people may be able to actually have standing to file a lawsuit against the president. So I think that Trump's attorneys are, now again, that'll be tested by the courts, and I'm not a lawyer myself, but there's a good chance that Trump's attorneys are right when they say that he is doing nothing illegal here. The question is not only whether or not there's a conflict of interest, but the appearance thereof, and whether or not this harms our faith in the president's ability to execute his office if he is taking in money while he is doing the people's
business. Well, and in fact, let me take that point argument and or that what you're suggesting there and extend it to foreign policy. We know that the president in his trip to Saudi Arabia bent over backward to deal.
But did not bow forward.
But he, oh, all right.
He curtsied. He
bent over backwards to be extraordinarily gracious to the Saudis. He did not mention human rights in any of his remarks while he was there. He took the Saudis' side in the in what we're going through right now
with Qatar.
With Qatar. Much to the dismay of many in the foreign policy in the State Department here. And so even though you can't help but think, how does the money that is going into his hotel, and you point out 500 other properties around the world that his company controls, impact foreign policy, which may not be illegal, but certainly raises doubts? Yes, Alex?
That's right. And, you know, beyond the Saudi example, I mean, take, for example, the Philippines. President Trump has had an unusually warm relationship with the Philippine president who, according to, you know, international human rights groups, is carrying out a campaign of extrajudicial killings in the tens of thousands in an attempt to stamp out that country's drug problem. We've seen sort of his statements of support for Erdogan in Turkey, you know, even amid, you know, we've seen this unusual situation where there's Erdogan's bodyguards, you know, beating up protesters just up Massachusetts Avenue from the White House. So, you know, it's an open question, really. We don't know. There's no evidence of any quid pro quo or anything. We don't have anything that suggests that Trump administration policy was directly affected by his business interests around the world. But the fact that they exist, the fact that he is drawing an ongoing revenue stream from the existence of these properties, from licensing agreements, from luxury hotels, from residential towers all over the world. That, when it dovetails with some, you could say, unusual behavior towards foreign countries, is enough to raise questions, I think, in the eyes of a lot of people.
We have some tweets at PoliticsGPB, and one of them, I think, is one that I was going to ask you about myself. Adam Kahn says, will you discuss the building of the new FBI headquarters and who has bid to get the old headquarters its prime real estate? Am I recalling this? I read your article the other day. You mentioned the FBI building in your piece.
It's an excellent question, but unfortunately, I'm actually not up to speed
well,
on
but
that.
There
I don't
is,
know.
Okay, then it isn't you.
But there is a bidding process underway, I know.
And there is a bidding process underway, and I apologize that I wasn't sure if it was your piece or another piece, but there is some question as to whether there is a company bidding on that has close ties to the Trump businesses. I do know that, and I apologize that I don't have more details about that. But Alex, there's another story for you to look into.
You're right. Yeah,
I apologize about that. Angela Ford tweets, he loves being praised, and anyone who wants something knows how to do it through his hotels. We have a number of other tweets here. Also, can you stay with us for another couple minutes while we take a quick break, Alex?
Sure.
All right. Let's do that. Let's take a break. We're going to finish up the conversation with Alex Altman from Time Magazine and then talk about some state issues while you're listening to Political Rewind on Monday afternoon.
What makes you trust somebody? Maybe they're consistent and reliable. Maybe they motivate you. Maybe they challenge you to think differently. Whatever the reason, millions of people tune into NPR and stations like this every day because they trust our journalism. Please stand with the facts. Help us continue to bring you the reliable and challenging programming that you depend on every day. It's really easy. Here's how you can help out. Go to gpb.org and click donate at the top of the page. And thanks for your support.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Theron Johnson, Brian Robinson, Jim Galloway in the studio. And with us from NPR headquarters in Washington, Alex Altman. Alex, as we finish up on our discussion of your cover piece for Time on the president's business conflicts of interest, I know it's not your job to propose a remedy. It's your job to uncover facts. But what do you imagine where we're headed with all of this? Is it just going to linger for the 4 years of the Trump presidency?
I think that's probably a safe bet. I mean, as we've seen, Trump has mingled his business and his his role as a politician and now as president from the very beginning of his campaign. I mean, during his campaign for president, he dragged reporters, his press corps in tow to, 10 or more properties, and even interrupting his campaign at a crucial juncture last summer to go visit the grand opening of a golf course in Scotland. And since he's become president, we've seen that virtually every weekend he goes and he visits one of his properties playing golf at his courses in Virginia and New Jersey, jetting down to Mar-a-Lago in South Florida, where it should be noted the entrance fee, the initiation fee has doubled to $200,000 a year since he became president. So, one of the things that he has done, which has defied precedent and the way that presidents have typically handled this type of thing, is he has essentially used the presidency as advertising for his corporate empire around the world. He's harnessed high office as a marketing opportunity pretty much from the jump, from stepping on the political scene, even announcing in his own Trump Tower in New York. So it's not something that I would expect him to change now because, as I think you guys noted, it's not something that he's been punished for.
Yeah. Alex, how much of a precedent is this? I mean, is this? I mean, are we going to see? Are we at an end of watching the of engaging with presidents who separate themselves or cut themselves off economically from the rest of the country? I mean, we've got the head of Facebook right now touring Iowa. I kind of doubt that if he runs for president, he's going to divest himself now.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think that, obviously Trump has shattered precedent in so many different ways. And one of the big ones is opening the door to people like Mark Zuckerberg, moguls like Mark Cuban, who say, well, this guy did it. Why can't I? And so Howard Schultz of Starbucks is another sort of whose name is bandied about. So what we may see is, as you note, is sort of an avalanche of businessmen deciding that, high office is their new calling. And whether now that sort of Trump has broken the seal here, I think it's quite possible that, if we do have another executive from the C-suite move into the Oval Office, that they'll decide to handle their interests in a similar way.
All right. Alex Altman, thank you so much for joining us. And that last exchange with Galloway over if this is the new standard is really interesting. So we'll watch both how the White House handles the business interests of Donald Trump and how the next batch of presidential candidates deal with whatever business interests they have and whether we do, in fact, have a new way of life with our presidents. Alex Altman, thank you so much for joining us from Washington for Political Rewind.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. All right, you guys, let's move on. Let's talk about some state issues. I've been looking forward to having this conversation with the three of you since this morning when I saw that former Governor Roy Barnes has endorsed Stacey Evans for the Democratic nomination for governor. There are two Democrats in the race officially right now, Stacey Evans, state rep, and Stacey
Abrams,
who is the minority leader in the House. Stacey Abrams is African-American. Stacey Evans is white. And in this case, saying that is part of the conversation we're going to have. It's not gratuitous. First of all, Jim Galloway, the fact that it wasn't surprising Barnes would endorse Evans probably, but my gosh, this thing is still like 17 months away. People are moving fast in this
race.
Right.
It was the timing more than anything else. I mean, look, Stacey Evans has been kind of a she and Barnes are type. There's a kind of a Cobb County connection there that everybody knows about. She's from Smyrna. He lives in Marietta right now. But it was you're right. It was the timing. It was. I mean, we're not even 7 days away from the 6th district defeat yet.
Look, I think the timing was perfect. I mean, if you're Stacey Evans right now, you're running against someone who has launched their campaign nationally. You're running against someone who has all these women's groups in and out of the state who are willing to contribute to her campaign. And then lastly, listen, Roy Barnes is still one of the most popular Democrats in the state of Georgia. And so I think that it was a strategy on behalf of Stacey Evans to wait until the Ossoff race was over. And more importantly, Jim, it gives her now the ability to go out and raise the millions and millions of dollars by using Roy Barnes's name, but also having Governor Barnes, you know, raise money for her as well. I mean, let's not forget, Governor Barnes is still the former governor who raised $22 million for an unsuccessful bid for governor. And so I think his networks are really wide, and she's got to raise some money quickly, because it is the perception that with this national campaign, really not a Georgia campaign, but this national launch with Stacey Abrams, that Evans has got to get her name out there, and she's got to raise some money pretty quickly.
I think going after the John Ossoff model, the one that will emerge will be the one who can pull the most money out of San Francisco, Georgia, or New York, Georgia, those two local places that Ossoff tapped so effectively in the 6th district race. And I'd bet that the two of them will be gathering some sky miles over the next few months.
What happened to the calm and measured Brian Robinson, who used to come in here and talk so, you know, much more in a bipartisan way about you've become incredibly partisan all of a sudden.
We're back in campaign season, man. This is no longer pie in the sky, think big. This is like how we make a living. Right. And by the way, I do want to clarify something. You said 17 months. It's less than a year.
Correct.
The primary is
well, that's right. You're right. I apologize. I was thinking general election. Thank you.
And so this is a key time.
Yeah,
and things to keep in mind, as Theron knows, Jim knows, is coming up at the end of the week is June 30th, and that is very important in campaign world, because you got to disclose to Georgians how much money you've raised and from where and from whom, and you will kind of see who's serious and perhaps who's not.
Okay, so let me add one more wrinkle to this and then get a broader discussion from all of you about it. We also had a statement from Paul Begala the other day. Many people who are a little bit older will remember that Paul Begala and James Carville ran Zell Miller's campaign for governor in 1990, and then again, we're overseeing it to some extent in 1994. In fact, it was the 1990 governor's race that made Carville and Begala put him on the map. It was Zell Miller who suggested that Clinton hire those two guys to be his campaign consultants. Okay, so Begala says Stacey Evans, Jim, is the kind of Democrat we need. What is this all about? What is happening here?
Okay, she's got to, you got to go see, we can't do it here, but you got to go see the video that she put out a couple weeks ago, basically telling about her childhood and growing up. She and I think Casey Kegel are the only ones who can truly say that they grew up in mobile homes. I think Stacey Evans says she lived in 16 houses over her childhood. So it was a very way up in North Georgia.
It's a J.D. Vance story in a lot of ways. I mean, Hillbilly Elegy could be the name of her video.
Oh yeah,
really.
Yeah. If you have lost the white working class and you're trying to get them back, she is an excellent voice. What it does though is you've also got at this time you got Abrams kind of playing a different kind of strategic game in that, and she's looking at the changing Georgia and seeing that, you know, that white voters aren't going to be long in the majority.
That's where I think that's where
she is trying to build a more diverse coalition.
That's where this becomes.
Yeah, and look, this show is, you know, we're very candid on this show. So listen, the conversation that's happening right now within the Democratic Party is race, and how do we talk about it, and how do we deal with it? What I think is unfair to both Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans, and I had a conversation with a very prominent state senator who's probably listening right now, and the whole conversation was, well, why does this white woman, you know, from Cobb County decide that she wants to run for governor when this black woman, just because she's black, has, you know, earned the right to run for governor? And what I explained to the senator is that Democrats in this state, we've been talking about race for over 100 years. So it's not an uncomfortable topic in our party, unlike the Republican Party that never talks about race, because there's not many people of color that emerge to do anything on Georgia politics and Georgia party. But what I want to be on the record for saying as a Georgia Democrat, you know, I'm probably going to support one of the two Stacys in this race. And if I decide to go with either one of them, it's not going to be based on the premises of race. It's going to be based on the premises is on who is the best person to go against a Republican. And it may be Mike Williams. I mean, if he continues to go on CNN and don't know what a CBO is.
Williams being another Republican candidate for governor who had a very, very bad appearance on CNN.
I mean, we may get so lucky as Democrats to draw that guy, right? But my point is that we've got to deal with this head on, because you got two qualified women who want to run for higher office, and we should not allow our party to be getting into what rural white voters will think about an African American woman, and quite frankly, what African American women may think about a white woman from North Georgia who grew up a lot like a lot of African Americans in this state. Not all of them. I mean, I'm thankful and blessed to be not a person who grew up in trailer parks, but there are a lot of my friends out there that can relate to a Stacey Evans story.
Hey, yeah. I want to set you up and then let you comment. Ted Barfield tweets us, nice try trying to link Stacey Evans to Zell Miller. There is no modern Dem in the mold of Zell Miller, Sam Nunn, or sane Dems of old, which, by the way, is an interesting observation and one that I want to expand on a little bit. You go ahead.
And Stacey Evans is running on the kind of Preserving the Hope Scholarship, which is a Zell legacy, of course. But I talked to Stacey Abrams this morning, and you know, and asked her just to get her reaction from Barnes's endorsement. And basically, she says this is a choice between the coalition of 1998 and the coalition of the future. That right now she would guess that that white voters, whites make up 52% of the population, 48% are people of color. But then she added something to that, and she says that's not reflected right now in voting trends, and that's where I think the problem is, because voting is a cultural habit, and it takes years and years and years for it to reflect the demography as Democrats are finding out right now. And I think there is some worry among some Democrats that it may be 52-48 racially in Georgia. But voter
turnout among African Americans is lower.
No, it's not among registered voters. It's getting them registered and getting
that's
them counted.
That's my point.
And, yeah,
right.
Yeah,
that's
but I think the thing I think we got to be careful, Jim, is I think what this race is going to come down to, and this is going to be a piece I'm sure you're going to write, it's going to come down to the voting. It's going to come down to what did you do when you were in the state legislature, when it came to issues about early voting, when it came to issues of voting rights, when it came to issues of how do you preserve hope? Do you go cut a deal with a Republican governor, or do you fight with your caucus to make sure that everything is in the Hope Scholarship cuts that, you know, we need to preserve things are in there? But the other thing is that I think Stacey Evans, who's a person who I've known for over 20 years, we started in the Young Democrats together. What she's got to do with this Roy Barnes endorsement, she's got to now pivot and come back with something that shows that she is this millennial. I think she's younger than Stacey Abrams. So I wouldn't so far to say that Abrams is going to be able to come out and say, hey, I'm the candidate that the millennials are all going to support. I think Evans will have an opportunity to come back and take some of that.
So, Brian, in the Political Insider blog this morning, I don't know if it was you, Jim, or Bluestein, quoted Ed Kilgore, who we all remember used to work for Zell Miller, was a staffer for Zell and now writes for New York Magazine. He says the old formula for statewide success among Georgia Democrats in the post-civil rights era had been 40-90, 40% of the white vote, 90% of the African-American vote. As the 21st century unfolded, the Democratic share of the white vote steadily sank. John Kerry won 23% of the white vote in Georgia in 2004. More alarmingly, moderate conservative white Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Taylor won 27% of the white vote in 2006. Those are telling numbers, Brian Robinson, and those are voters who are all going over to the Republican Party.
Yeah, and In Georgia, I believe Governor Deal got closer to 80% of the white vote in both of his runs. So, now, granted, one thing we have to keep in mind is Republicans in statewide races cannot continue to depend on 80% margins amongst white people.
No, the one thing to keep in mind, Bill, is those numbers that have switched over, those are older voters.
Yeah, they're dying off, too. And so there is a existential crisis for the party in the state that we have got to, one, recreate that coalition every day as some of the older voters begin to die off and bring in new blood. And because it is a 52-48% state, it can no longer be a white people party and then an everybody else with a few white people party. We, you know, Republicans can't have that dynamic anymore. We're going to have to start diversifying our party base. And I do think, even though we haven't been terribly successful, I do think we're at least trying. We are showing up. And if you look at what Governor Deal has done on criminal justice reform, it's going to be stuff like that, where you are dramatically improving the lives and the communities of minorities in this state, and then going out and saying, here's what I've done, which is what we did in 2014.
And there's going to be some symbolism out there, too. I mean, on the 28th of August, you're going to have Governor Nathan Deal unveiling the statue of MLK on state capitol grounds.
Yeah, but
that was all him.
It was all him.
Well, he had some help from some Democrats. He had people like Calvin Smyre and others.
We went to Calvin.
Okay, yeah. So let's not say it was all him. I mean, you had Calvin. Let's give Calvin Smyre his due. But here's the thing I want to get out of. Look, yes, Governor Deal has done great for criminal justice reform. But here's the problem we have in the state. Every time a Republican goes out here and they do something, and it's a symbolic gesture to do something for people of color, you give them all this praise. But I want to see Governor Deal when it comes to a conversation about voting rights in this state. I want to see what Governor Deal is on this, when he can expand Medicaid to make sure that African-Americans, predominantly African-Americans, who right now don't have any access to health care. I think that's the problem that the Republicans are going to have. But back to the two Stacys. The other thing that I want to say is this, and I'm trying to say this early, Bill, on your show, because this is a show that everyone listens to, and these are the insiders. If we get into this battle off this Ossoff loss that we had, which was a sad loss for us, but we've got to get over it. We got to move on. If we now go after this young man has raised over $20 million, and whether he, you know, focused on the right issues or not, he ran a good campaign. He did better than everyone thought he was going to do. But if we allow the Republicans to turn Democrats on each other about why can't a white rural woman like Stacey Abrams be running against a black woman from Metro Atlanta who's a leader of a party who's sat by and earned it, and we get into this whole race conversation, we are already losing. We've got to figure out a way to let it be about the issue.
But that's going to be – we got to get a break in. That's going to be tricky, Theron. Having a young white female gubernatorial candidate against a well-respected African-American Democrat – I wish you well, but we know how tricky that is going to be for Democrats to pull off.
I've got their own solution. Just a bumper sticker that says, vote for Stacey.
All right, we got to get a break in. I'm way late on getting our second break in. Let's do it right now and come back. We'll talk Donald Trump and a couple other quick things.
On the next Fresh Air, America's infatuation with gold. We'll talk with James Ledbetter, author of One Nation Under Gold, how one precious metal has dominated the American imagination for four centuries. He'll talk about the history of this precious metal and explain what the gold standard is and why some politicians would like to return to it. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back, Brian Robinson, Theron Johnson, Jim Galloway in the studio. I mentioned it in the start of the show, so I'll say it very quickly. Maybe we'll talk about it at some other point. Jim, Greg Bluestein writes today, the Georgia House had the nation's highest rate of uncontested seats among legislatures in 2016. Interesting.
Right. What he's pointing to is an Associated Press study of a national study of state legislatures, and says we get the prize. We get the prize for the most uncontested state House and state Senate races in the nation.
That's not good for Political Rewind.
You know, and here's the thing. That's another conversation, you know, we're having amongst ourselves as Democrats. And Brian and I talked about this last week. The one thing that the Ossoff race did do, I think, is that it generated a lot of momentum. But all over this country, you got people wanting to run for office, whether it's you didn't want Donald Trump to become president or you just don't like the way things are happening right now in your state and federal government. The fact that we have the most uncontested seats right now is really sad, because as a party and as a person who is begging DuBose Porter to do something to really go out here and to train and raise money so we can have people in all of these races when they want to run, is something that we've got to do. We cannot let Republicans off the hook. We're going to have about 3 Senate seats that are going to be up for play in November of next year. And we're going to probably have about maybe, you know, anywhere between 4 to 5 House seats that are actually going to be in play for Democrats. So we've got to start recruiting these people now and making sure we have a Democrat in every single seat that's winnable for us, and make sure they're running against the Republican.
All right, we got a few minutes. Go ahead, Brian, real quick.
Well, on this, we're getting toward the end of the decade of this last redistricting, meaning that the demographics have had time to change dramatically. A lot of, you know, egress and moving in. And as it moves further away from 2011, the more competitive some of these races may become, because they're no longer what they were drawn to be. And so you're going to see some competitive races in Gwinnett, in South Cobb, in Henry County. And so some of this is going to change as we get towards the end of the decade.
Good point. Good point. Thank you for making it. Okay, let's move on to health care. The president, Mitch McConnell, want that bill passed this week.
As he came out on Facebook recently, you may have seen it. He said, your bill, Mr. President, not a health care bill. It's a massive transfer of wealth. It's going to harm Americans. It's mean. What do you say to the former president?
Well, he actually used my term, mean. That was my term, because I want to see, and I speak from the heart. That's what I want to see. I want to see a bill with heart.
President Trump on Fox and Friends over the weekend, doing what he can to really give support to Mitch McConnell in his effort.
And if you missed that, he confirmed a story that had only been sourced before, a Washington Post story that said he had called it in a private meeting with senators. He had called the bill mean. Yes, he confirmed that he did that.
And his people from the White House spent a lot of time basically inferring that the president did not say that. And now he just comes out and basically says, I said it.
And Brian, he wanted to make sure that everybody knew this was his word. This was not President Obama's word.
Well, you know, he's now saying that the tweet about the tapes, in quotation marks, tapes, was strategic because it kept coming from going out and lying about it. So you wonder if maybe this is strategic, and what he is doing is allowing the Republicans to vote on a far-right bill that will keep their primary voters happy, and then come to a more politically sensible and rewarding compromise, and they can say, look, we had to meet the president halfway. We wanted the most conservative, but the president wanted something more liberal. So maybe it's just a giant, brilliant strategy.
All right, so Senator McConnell still says he's going to try to get a vote before the week is out. And that's Thursday, because gosh knows, the Senate's not going to stay in session on a Friday when they've got a long 4th of July weekend ahead of them.
But our very own Senator Perdue, and I'm surprised Brian didn't jump in here and say this, is that he got a lot of national credit and a little bit of criticism for saying, you know what, the Senate should stay in. We should not go on recess. We should actually stay here and do the work of the American people.
But
we know that Republicans are not going to do that.
All right, there's a lot of pressure on both sides of this. AARP is running this ad.
All right, let's get started. You're both over 50?
Yes.
Okay, that'll cost you.
Why?
The new health care bill in Congress. If you're over 50, insurance companies can charge you 5 times more. It's an age tax. Any pre-existing conditions?
I have asthma.
Okay, well, insurers can charge thousands more for that. This is going to be a big bill.
That's an older couple meeting with their tax accountant and being told about the trouble they're in.
And if I'm not mistaken, that ad came out right after the House version, right? I mean, that's...
But they've been... that's right, and it's back. It's reactivated as the Senate votes. All right, we've got 5 senators apparently still opposed to this bill. There are efforts. We know that there were a couple of changes that came out today. I mentioned one at the top of the show. I haven't had a chance, none of us has, to look at the others. Jim, trying to get a vote out of this by the end of the week seems unrealistic. And you got to wonder if it's true that maybe they just as soon not pass this bill and let Obamacare keep going.
or remember back in the day when sometimes bills were put on the floor without good vote counts, you put them out there, you let people vote. If it fails, well, you pull the bill back and you try again. And in doing so, you show the public the process that's being worked at and the hurdles that stand in front of them, and maybe they'll be a little bit more forgiving when they don't completely repeal Obamacare.
Brian, what's really interesting is that Senator Heller out in Nevada is one of those five who said he's against the bill. And there's a PAC closely associated with President Trump that has bought time to attack him for not supporting this bill. Now, I don't see how that's good for Republicans as a party when you have a PAC affiliated with the president going after one of your own.
You know, Farron all the time complains about Democrats cannibalizing their own and stepping on their own feet and getting in their own way. And I usually agree with him on that point. But we are just as guilty. We are just as much into the circular firing squad as they are. I think we hate each other more than we do the Democrats and vice versa. And in Nevada, it's one thing to go after a senator representing a solidly red state, like in Alabama or in Texas. It's totally different in Nevada, where a Democrat has a serious chance of winning that against the incumbent Republican, and we lose a seat. It is very counterproductive. Let's let Dean Heller do what he needs to do for his own politics and then wait and see if he comes back around.
Yeah, Theron, it's interesting that Brian says it, because there was a point last week when they didn't realize how much difficulty they might have getting all these Republican senators on board, that there was talk about doing just what Brian said. Wouldn't it be great if we had enough votes to pass this without Dean Heller and we can protect him in his bid for reelection?
That was exactly the strategy. And I think two things happened. One, you have a Senate majority leader who clearly does not have a working relationship with this president. And the president basically goes out and basically says what he said. And then two, I think that a lot of these U.S. senators went home and had those town hall meetings. And I think that if you look at the common thread between all of the four or five people who've said no, they all are in districts which had a huge amount of resistance and a negative response to the House version of the health care bill. So I think they've got to go back and explain to their constituents how they can do this. But Brian is right. I mean, listen, the people who are really suffering from the Republicans not being able to get their act together when they control the White House, the Senate, and the House, when the people who are truly suffering are the American people right now, because a lot of folks are in limbo, not knowing what type of access they're going to have to health care right now.
Jim Galloway, real quick. Meanwhile, Trump has been tweeting up a storm today about Russia and President Obama. We're not going to get into that today. We don't have time. The Democrats have become nothing but obstructionists in all capital letters. They have no policies or ideas. All they do is delay and complain. They own Obamacare. And a second tweet, Republican senators are working very hard to get there with no help from the Democrats. Not easy. Perhaps just let OCARE crash and burn.
There's a difference between not participating and not being allowed in the room, I would say. I would say just something to keep in mind. How much time have I got?
About 20 seconds.
Georgia State University public health poll took a look at hyper-segregated white communities in America. Spike in breast cancer. Huge spike in breast cancer deaths. That's Trump territory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. Thank you for giving us a place to finish the show today. Jim Galloway, Brian Robinson, Theron Johnson. We are out of time for today's show. Wednesday, we're back at 2. I'm really looking forward to it because the mayor of Columbus, the very successful mayor of Columbus, Teresa Tomlinson, who many think is going to be a big star in the Democratic Party statewide and maybe nationally coming up, will be here. We'll talk to her and hope you're here with us for that show. I'm Bill Nygut. See you on Wednesday.